Dr. Joanna Emily is a poet and a teacher, creative writing. Her last collection of poetry, Family History, formed part of her thesis, I think, and dealt with loss and with the need for humanity in the medical sphere. And it focused on her mother, who had terminal cancer and, in fact, died in a car accident. Her latest collection is called Felt, which she says is about the things she feels most strongly about: friendship, climate change, animals. In fact, the cover is a felt puppet goat. Dr. Emily keeps goats on her rural property north of Auckland, and they feature in a couple of the poems. Ruminant beauties, you call them, Jo.
Indeed.
They are endearing, aren't they?
Well, they're really endearing, and they're also, I think, among the most sentient and intelligent animals I've come across. I feel sad that I didn't find out about them earlier.
How can you tell that they're sentient and intelligent?
Oh, so many ways. I wish you were on Facebook, Kim, because you could see the many videos, for example, of Rosanna, my Nubian goat, scratching herself with
Nubian's
a stick.
Nubian's the one with the long ears.
They are.
They're adorable.
And Rosanna can also scratch herself with the right side of a broom. She can turn it so that she gets the bristles and scratches her back.
She can use tools.
She can use tools. She's weaponized also.
She's weaponized?
Yes. And Bluey, the other dairy goat, that we have, she can actually milk herself. That's why she was fired from the dairy. Kim looks quizzical.
How can she milk herself?
She can milk herself by just popping her head under, standing on three legs, cocking one leg up, and milking herself. That's why she was fired from the dairy.
Oh, that sounds vaguely wrong.
My husband thought so at first, but I kind of persuaded him that it was genius.
It is kind of genius, although also wrong.
Yeah, agreed.
This photo on the cover of your book of a felt goat has also got a link to Georgia.
It really has.
Tbilisi it came from.
That's right. So I went in search. I'm so lucky to have a publisher who allows me, Nicola Leggett, who allows me to indulge my passion for choosing cover images. And I decided that I would really like a felted goat. And I went searching through images. And, of course, the one I found was the most difficult to get my hands on because the maker of the beautiful marionette, Olga Kupunia, lives in Tbilisi in Georgia. And so I undertook a mission to contact her and to get the rights to the picture. And I fell so in love with Greta, the goat, that I asked her to make me one and send her also.
And is that what she does, makes felt goats?
She does, and she makes marionettes for the local puppet theatre also.
How strange that you should come upon her and get the goat. Is it a Nubian goat?
No, it's the closest thing I could come across. It's actually a Boer goat.
All right. Why goats did you start with? Did you meet goats and you fell in love with them and then you thought I must have them?
Okay, well, what happened was I was looking for a pet that would make me want to get up in the morning and feed an animal and enjoy an animal. And I was teaching with my friend Rosalie.
Does your husband ever say, why don't you want to get up in the morning for me, Joe?
Well, he's already gone to school and he loves the goats equally, which is just great.
Does he?
He does.
Did you have to persuade him that goats were a good idea?
I did have to persuade him, but like every animal I get, he's soon a convert. And in fact, when Bluey had to have her ovaries removed, he slept in the barn with Bluey overnight to comfort her.
Why did she have to have her ovaries removed?
Because she got polycystic ovarian syndrome, which was turning her slowly into a buck.
And do goats suffer from these kind of things more than other things?
I'm not sure, but Bluey certainly has had her share of problems like that. And
seems quite complicated.
It really was. They're complicated and most excellent. But the reason I got them was that Roz and I were teaching this class for over 55s, and one lady, Alice Hooton, wrote a beautiful poem about her childhood in Ireland and these goats that came and ate the laundry off the line.
Yes.
And I thought, that is the animal I want.
And so there are many, many animal poems in Felt.
Mm.
And I don't know whether what you want to read features any of them.
Well, I have an eel poem and a goat poem, Shelter from the Storm.
Let us have the goat poem, okay, first while we're on the subject.
Okay, and this also, I mean, whenever we write about animals, I think that we're using them in some way as a mirror.
Is that anthropomorphic?
I'm not sure if it's anthropomorphizing them, yeah, but I do feel that we project onto animals, and I certainly do in this poem. So there are two types of goats in this poem, and one type of goat is me and one type of goat is my husband. So, yes, this one's...
The world is divided.
Into two types of goat.
All
it's,
right.
It's really true. I could write a whole book about it. Shelter from the storm, while rain washed the hills and we watched from the loud safety of a graffitied bus shelter, I asked you why it was that some of those goats chose to huddle desperate under rock shelves to flatten themselves in pairs or threes against the insubstantial eaves of cliffs, while others browsed on, gradually devouring the hill, across and down, as if it were an amusing crossword. And you could not answer. Didn't have a clue.
Ah. And which one is you?
I am the one constantly trying to shelter from the storm of life, and my husband is the one, like the men in the new Catlin Moran book, who you'll be driving along saying, what are you thinking? What are you thinking? Tell me what you're thinking. And the man just says, I'm not thinking anything.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm. So he's the one that's just going, it's raining, that's okay, I'll just browse along here. Yeah.
Somebody, if she's listening, she'll forgive me for mentioning this, but I won't name her, said to me the other day that the difference between her and her husband is that she's constantly thinking, and he genuinely doesn't long periods of time.
Yeah, and as women we need to accept that. And stop projecting onto them too and expecting them to be thinking just as much.
Last time we spoke, you were in quite a lot of pain, I think.
Mm.
Tell me about that.
Well, I suppose from about the age of 35, I developed a condition that's quite rare. I think about 1 in 100,000 people is cursed with it, and it's called erythromelalgia. And it took quite a while to get diagnosed with it.
What is it?
It causes your hands and feet to overreact to stimuli, so to overreact to heat, for example, or if you're standing for a long time, your hands, your feet will get very hot and red and painful, and it's a neurovascular disorder. So
only your hands and feet are afflicted?
Sometimes the face can be affected with people. It was very difficult. It took 2 years to get this diagnosis. And after that, it took probably another 2 years to find medications that actually worked, because there isn't a curative. But what happens is you find drugs that will dampen down the hyperexcitability of that part of the nervous system that makes the small vessels expand.
Drugs have side effects?
I
mean, I don't want to pry too deeply, but it seems to me...
Yeah, no, I won't give you the super personal ones.
If you go, but if you have drugs that dampen down that, maybe they dampen down things you don't want to be dampened down.
You know, that's
down.
A great question. And when I was listening on the way over to your earlier guest to do with cognitive stuff...
Whatever her name was.
You've used that joke once already.
Sorry. Was it only a once-er?
The thing about one of the drugs, which is an anticonvulsant, so one that people with epilepsy take, is that it gives you a kind of aphasia. And for me, that was so frustrating. So all of my words would go. And so I'd be saying to David, can you get the socks out of the thing it's square and you pull it out with the handles?
Ah.
And that was very limiting. So when I did my PhD Viva, I was loaded up on ephedrine so that it would counteract that, so I could actually talk properly. So what I've done over the last year is I've taken that drug down to half so I can actually string a sentence together, because I found it just unbearable not to be able to talk properly.
You were able to write?
Yes, but I found that the words didn't come as easily, and certainly they still don't come as easily as they used to, but I just have to put up with it. And I think that's the key to any chronic illness or any chronic condition, is that until you can actually find your acceptance and your management, you're completely lost to yourself. And I suppose that's why I really didn't want to discuss the condition previously, because no. I hadn't reached that point where it was under management,
right,
or where I could accept that I had it and that was part of my identity.
Right.
So it's
You still felt as an individual that you were deeply threatened by it.
Really threatened, and there's a degree of shame that goes along with it.
What's the
and
shame?
And it shouldn't. Well, anything that you feel lessens you as a person. And there shouldn't be shame in having a chronic condition, but there is. Mm. And I think when you have one, you feel less of who you were before. And I think once you create that space of managing and accepting, you no longer feel less than. And that's really important. And anyone out there who has a chronic condition, please try and find that place.
How did you find that place?
I certainly didn't find it alone. And anyone trying to handle that sort of thing, please don't try and find it alone, like everything in life. So I found it with the help of two really good doctors who actually listened and walked alongside. And I helped it. I was helped by the pain clinic in Green Lane, who had wonderful group sessions with chronic pain patients from all walks of life, and not only helped us by education, but helped us with physiotherapy, getting people active again who'd been scared to be active. And so the other thing I think that pulls people through is the help of friends, and friends are not always wanting to discuss the condition, but wanting to discuss other things with you because you're not just your condition. So those things all together were absolutely fantastic, plus the intervention of the health psychologist at Waitemata, Dita Dvorak, who after five sessions with me turned my whole thinking around about having a chronic condition. So don't think that you can just fix it yourself, even if you are like me, a terrible A-type personality. You can't fix it yourself. Get people to help you. And
do you mind me asking you about this?
Not in the slightest.
I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, how did she, for example, turn your attitude around?
Dita was marvellous. And when I went in, sat me down and said to me, I think it's called cognitive behavioural therapy or acceptance and commitment therapy, one of the two, I've forgotten, that's a long time ago.
Right.
Reframed my thinking so that I was no longer focusing on the one, if you imagine a pie chart or the Chesdale slices that we used to get in the nice little segments, it was no longer that I was focusing that all of my life was this condition, but that it was just one little segment and I needed to think just about managing that segment and how it would fit in. So that was hugely helpful, and I think that the provision of someone like Dita, who can help you with your thinking with a chronic health problem, is hugely helpful.
It's completely under control now.
No, it's not completely under control now.
So you have to, is it a daily thing for you to manage
in
it?
In the summer, it is quite bad. During the winter, it's great, but the medicine regime I'm on at the moment is fantastic and really helps.
Right. You've taken up riding again as a consequence of being able to... manage this
and
a little better.
Yeah, in the past year I've taken up riding again, and I go riding every week with my neat new friend Lynette, and my husband and I, we take our miniature ponies walking down to the pony club and jumping over little jumps. And
are they bad tempered, those miniature ponies?
Well, let me think.
Because, you know, I've always had it in my head that the smaller the pony, the worse temper it has.
I don't believe so.
For possibly obvious reasons, I don't know.
One of them, when I first got her, she had quite a funny temper, but then we extracted a rather large rotten tooth from her mouth and hey-ho, her temper changed. Oh. So perhaps a lot of the miniature ones have rotten teeth and not rotten tempers.
Oh. So you've turned your attention to felt in the sense of feeling things. For any particular reason, what's the origin story of this collection?
So when you name a collection, obviously you're looking for something really multi-connotative and something that will make the person who sees your book think, oh, I wonder what she means by that. And oh, look, there's that funny little felted goat. That's funny. But also, I noticed that a lot of the poems in the book, whether they were about couples going through therapy or whether they were about a teacher regretting that she hadn't reached out more to a student who always came in with knotted hair at the back, or about an old lady who is going to swim fit and hangs at the back until one day she touches you. They all had something to do with body-to-body contact and the way in which it has such a huge emotional force, whether it's that discomforting feeling in the couple's therapy poem where the couple are given the exercise to stand close to each other and hold each other and it's so hard, or whether in the hydrotherapy poem the old lady recognises someone who looks like her sister she left and lost long ago. So I thought it was a great title because so much of life is corporeal. So much of life is about the embodiment of our emotionality. And it's something that we've missed during the lockdowns, etc. So, yes, that's why the title.
There is a poem called I Am Losing You Again.
Yes.
Which I want to ask you about.
Sure.
Do you mind me asking you about the origin of some of these? Because that seems particularly personal.
That is a particularly personal one, so I probably won't talk about the origin of it or the catalyst of it, but I just think that this poem in particular again talks about the difficulties of loving someone and not being able to have the proximity to them that you really want when you feel that they're in trouble and danger. So that's the funny thing about poetry, you know, it can be catalyzed by such personal experiences. And yet when you write about them, you've got to be so careful that you're not being too revelatory. Because you want to express the emotion and you want to make a personal story universal. Yes. So that you're touching people, but you don't want to be revelatory when the entire story is not your own.
No, that's right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. No,
trying
it does.
To be difficult.
It does. We spoke last time about, I think, whether you can have good poetry which is also autobiographical or confessional.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, damn it, yes, you can.
Yeah.
And there seems to be no doubt in your mind, but is it men that prefer to be more oblique and opaque about their poetry? I don't know.
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure whether it's men or women. I think there are schools of thought about whether the I lyric, you know, the I in poetry that has autobiography at its centre is relevant, or whether it's just in inverted commas blogging or some sort of misery memoir in verse. But I feel that something personal about poetry is always going to make it connect with people much more. I mean, some of these poems contain not my story, but they are stories that people have told to me, and I've thought, oh, the poignance of that.
Mm.
And in some cases, I've asked people, for example, the couples therapy poem, I said to the person, would you mind if I published this poem?
Not your husband.
Not my husband. Not my husband. But, you know, I just thought, what a difficult
I just thought
position.
When you heard he was sleeping with the goat, it might have all turned to mush.
I can share him with Bluey, but that's as far as it goes.
I know. So did you go back to the people and say, look, I'm writing this poem. It's not necessarily about you, and I certainly won't reveal who you are.
As far as I could, I did.
Mm.
So, for example, the couples therapy poem and a poem called Prayer, which was, something that I'd written for a person, if you get my meaning.
Mm.
But where I could not approach a person and say, oh, you know, between us, you would recognise yourself in this poem. I mean, there's no way anyone could read any of my poems and say, oh, that's so-and-so. But sometimes you like to share them with people.
Yeah. There's a long one called Favoured Exception, which I would like you to read, and we do have time.
Oh, great.
Do you want to talk me into this?
Sure, and I have, I was talking to the young man this one is for, and I've sent him this, and he knows this has been published and read. And he'll always be really dear to me, and this is a young man who was, I think I was 24 when he was 14, and he was one of the first students I taught.
You love teaching.
I love teaching. It's a vocation, and whenever people ask me what I do, I always say I'm a teacher.
Why do you love it so?
I love it because it's a privilege. I love it because you are allowed to be up close and central in a young person's life without being their mother or father. And you will have some impact on that person, hopefully for the good, and you will be able to model to them what you think is important in life and maybe steer them at a really crucial time. If you're doing a full job, you know, there's a term I guess I could use, holistic, you know. You can be a holistic teacher if you really love it. And that means that if you have someone who's talented musician, you might look out for opportunities for them. If someone's a talented artist, you'll be constantly thinking, oh, I might push that person's way, because you're thinking about them a lot. So I think teaching is one of those jobs like medicine. It allows you to be up close. It allows you to have a personal relationship, and it allows you to impart knowledge about something you care deeply for, in my case, literature and writing.
So this is a poem called Favoured Exception.
Okay. Favoured Exception. I taught you perhaps a few anomalous spellings. By 13, you knew most of the usual words, but favoured exceptions, like supersede and rarefied. Black ballpoint dragons rattled the margins of your stories. Their fierce impressions lasted several pages. At the nape of your neck, there was often a knot. Your free hand would worry it as you wrote, making a fair coir above your collar. 30 now, and in dire emergency housing, you text me the difference between smack and crack, much as a patient stranger might explain to a foreigner what a ciggy is, or that grog and booze are the same. I am far outside this story, with its dealers from the capital up for the day to flex their muscles against the walls of the poor semi-detached calamities of your town. Littles, Johnson, men like Pinter parodies, squat and joke on your mother's piss-stained sofa, then go to serve body blows to bad buyers. I know you're smart enough to say your lines and leave. But what to do, kid, when your brain cells tick like bored fingernails on a table and psychedelics are a tenor a pop, when your shoes have remnant soles and you're sleeping on bare bed slats? Still, I have only an English teacher's advice. Just as back in our old days I could not make my fingers reach to untangle your hair, could not spell you out of trouble with coded homework, nor keep you in school with wish-you-were-here postcards from her classroom. Is it too late to say the dragons are waiting in the margins until you come back with this electric connection of history and experience, your wit even quicker now in its hectic worldliness? Favoured exception, my words are warm and well-shod. They have never known neglect nor the censorship of terror. Forgive them. They're embarrassed by their comfortable home, their shy adherence to the rules. If it were possible, they would go back and tell my coward hands to touch your head, work free those knots.
Ah, that's Jo Emily reading her poem, Favoured Exception. How long have you been on your property with the goats for?
I have lived there with my husband since 2006, December 2006, yeah. 14 years?
Yeah, And you wanted a lifestyle. Is it a lifestyle thing?
Well, I grew up on 36 acres of horticultural farm. And
where?
In Coatesville.
Right.
And the same place as I live now. And I had to leave when I was 18 to go to university in England, and I didn't want to.
You went to Cambridge?
Yeah. And
you didn't want to go?
No. And so then, finally, when I could return...
Why did you then?
Because my parents always wanted to return to England, and the deal was if Cambridge took me, I would go with them. And...
You were obligated.
I was obligated.
Did you like it when you went there?
No.
Oh.
Yeah. I should have been less silly.
And look, sometimes things happen to us when we're too young.
That's right. I should have been less silly, and I should have missed home less, maybe. But I didn't. I missed home all the time and just wanted to get home. So when I was 32, I brought my Yorkshire husband home, and I couldn't be more thankful to be home.
One final poem, please, which is a short one. And it's called, in fact, the title is almost as long as the poem, Reading King Lear While the Old Man is in Hospital.
Mm. So, yes, everything went wrong in England. My mother died. My dad got Parkinson's. Reading King Lear While the Old Man is in Hospital. We get up to vex not his ghost. Let him pass, I say, before he minds asking that water be lifted to his lips, tipped from a child's sipping cup, that this last button be unfastened.
Aye. You previously concentrated on humanising medicine or medical humanities, and there is some of that in this book. Obviously, because of the illness of your father, illness of your mother, the next one's called liver failure. This remains an interest of yours, does it?
It really does, and...
I mean, in your own experience, maybe, has brought to bear on this.
Hugely, hugely. And I've enjoyed 2 years ago now. I haven't been able to go back because of clashes with timetable, but two years ago, going to the med school, talking to the student doctors there and encouraging them to walk alongside their patients. That's all we want, walk alongside us. Don't pass us on to someone else. And I think it's hugely interesting. I've enjoyed writing a chapter for Routledge on disability and poetry, which is so richly interesting. So whole new worlds have opened up to me. And if you're stuck in a position of thinking your life is changing in a way that you cannot reverse, it's just that something else is evolving for you. So just hang on.
Wow. Somebody has texted me to say, beautiful poetry. I'm likely to now buy my first book of poetry.
Well, that's what we want.
Don't you think? Look, it's lovely to talk to you, Jo. Congratulations. Dr. Joanna Emeny, her book of poetry, your third collection, I think, it's called Felt. And it's worth it just for the cover, actually, but that is to undermine the contents, of course, which I do not mean to do.